Welcome back to another episode of the Juice Moves Podcast. This week's episode is with Noam Ivryadanani. Noam's a senior consultant at APCO Worldwide, who served in the Army in Israel and was called up for reserves after being evacuated from his hometown of Sde Rode at the beginning of the war. He has a fascinating journey with many unique experiences along the way. Noam, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Akiva. Good morning. Thank you for having me on here.
Thank you for joining. I guess we'll try to cover as much as we could and try to do it a little chronologically, if that's okay. But I'm curious, growing up in America, where and when did the idea formulate to maybe end up in Israel and eventually in the Army?
So it's a lot to unpack. I'll try and make it brief. But since early years, maybe middle school, high school already, I felt that America, as much as I loved it and many things about it, like baseball and Chinese food and this and that, that Israel was more of my home. I went on a bar mitzvah trip with my family. This was the summer of 2009 to give you of the 1999 to give you an impression of how old I am. And I just felt like after 2 weeks in that country, that I was leaving a piece of home. Like, I didn't want to go back to America. And then in high school, I did a summer program that was very connecting with Israelis and American high school students together, American Jewish high school students. And there was the second intifada. We actually knew someone who was killed in terrorist attacks. So, like, that was a very formative experience also, just really feeling, wow, I'm feeling the same pain as these people that were getting murdered in terrorist attacks, and just also the everything about the living a Jewish life with all the sources in Judaism, all the connections to the Tanakh, and a society now that's very thriving here. It just made so much more sense to me. So it was a journey that grew on me from just being a great place to visit and connect with my Jewish identity to being a place where I wanted to live and actualize that. And there's a final thing I'll briefly note is when I went to public school, I had some challenges learning in the Jewish day school system. So my parents moved me to public school, and there being from Shomer Shabbat Jew was very challenging, and just feeling very much on the outside when they had the Christmas celebrations as part of the school stuff or what kids were talking about. I mean, there wasn't really anti-Semitism, but just not feeling that this is my home and my culture, and very much feeling in Israel the opposite of that.
Oh, wow. I'm curious. I think before going, you learned Arabic and were involved with the Embassy of Jordan in Washington, D.C. Exactly. Can you speak a little bit about that? I guess learning Arabic and those pre-Israel experiences.
And I'll actually answer the last part of your first question that I neglected to say. The Army was part of the. I actually didn't think at the time when I started to think about Aliyah, Army or no Army, but it ended up being at my age and where I wanted to go in life. Acculturating into society was a great way to move up the ladder and give back something to the country and really be part of this society and have a more successful Aliyah in the long run. Now, as part of this genesis started in high school of me really wanting to make Aliyah and wanting to position myself, I started to learn Hebrew a lot on my own. I did an Ulpan in the summer before starting college. I went to George Washington University, Northeast, as people know, in Washington, D.C. But learning Arabic, I thought, is something as an extension of that, that I thought if I'm going to be here in all of my life, this is an important language to know on top of Hebrew, and they're very similar, so it could be a great base to jump off after knowing some Hebrew. And it wasn't also from a perspective of, oh, if we all know Arabic, then there'll be peace with us. And then the other idea also wasn't that, oh, if I need to know the language of my enemy. I said, no, this is just objectively, a lot of people around us are speaking Arabic, so let me start learning it. I did it in my undergraduate degree, 3 years of Arabic, and then I really wanted to push up to another level already, saying at some point I'm going to make Aliyah. So I went to Jordan in a sort of a graduate program they have, a post-college program for a lot of foreign students. Very intense learning, 6 hours a day. I would go to Israel for the Chagim because it was nearby. That's part of the reason I chose Jordan as opposed to, say, Morocco or another Arab country farther away. And it was also a very formative experience because there I saw, in their own words, in their own language, not knowing that I was an American Jew at that time, a lot of naked anti-Semitism that didn't make any distinction between Zionists or Jews, as they often say in public forums to Western audiences, but in their own place, all the types of Jew hatred, the Mein Kampf being sold and protocols of Zion and all these radio programs and TV that would incite against Jews. So it was a really formative experience. So I had to be very careful in saying what I was. And I finished that program. It was late 2008. So it was the Great Recession also. I was starting at that point, I thought I would look for jobs in America, work a few years, and then maybe even start a family, settle down, and then go to Israel with someone committed to that lifestyle. But things happened. There wasn't a lot out there outside of the U.S. public sector, the government. I didn't want to work for the government. So I decided to make Aliyah then and there about a year after finishing college with the fluent Arabic under my belt. And came Labor Day weekend 2009, right before Rosh Hashanah that year. And then as part of this process was enlisted in the Army. Given the age I was at, I was 23 at the time, so I had to do at least 6 months. I ended up signing on more time going to officer school and doing 3.5 years of service, which allowed me then to be put in the Miloim, the reserve duty. About a year after I discharged in 2014, they started calling me, and I would do them until October 7th, about 2 to 3 weeks a year, scattered throughout the year like that.
Wow. And before we discuss the Army, I'm curious, you know, when Jews in America or even in Israel think about ideal colleges or post-high school education systems for their children, Jordan's not usually what comes to mind. So I'm curious, you know, how did that idea formulate? And did you have to explain that to parents or friends a little more than a decision to go to other places would have been?
Absolutely. With my parents also, we went over sort of, we looked at different Arabic programs, including in Israel, different Israeli universities. But I came to the conclusion that just being in Jordan would give you that extra push. We're there. There's a lot of people that don't even speak English. And you'd really have to acculturate yourself. You'd have to, and you'd absorb the culture in Israel. Without elaborating too much, the Arabs already now 75 years as Israeli citizens, and at that point it was like 50, but still, they're very acculturated with, even their Arabic that they speak on the streets is very mixed in with Hebrew, and I wouldn't be getting the full Arabic exposure. But it's not a place, I knew I'd be going there for 6 months after I finished my bachelor's degree, and it's not a place that you would spend, even that time is a lot, but you're certainly not doing 4 years there would be very difficult. The practical stuff about Kashrut, about Shabbat, and everything beyond that also, of just being in a very hostile place if they know that you're Jewish, is not ideal. So I went over the things with my parents, and I think they were more encouraged by the fact that it's close to Israel, that the program itself for this Arabic study does have a good reputation among other programs. There was some I looked at in Qatar and in Morocco and Tunisia and a few other places, but this seemed like just the things lined up the best for what I was looking to get out of it. And certainly being close to Israel was also an improvement.
Oh, wow. And then so afterwards, you mentioned already you made Aliyah officially and you ended up in the Army. Yes. What was the Army experience like that you could talk about? And did the Arabic come in to help you there?
Yes, absolutely. I could generally say that I did end up doing two positions in the Army. I call it jokingly undergraduate and graduate. Undergraduate was before my officer's course, where I was actually on the border with Jordan as part of the Israeli Army, the IDF's foreign liaison coordination. So we'd actually do all this type of tactical coordination with them, like helping some of their trucks get to their Gaza field hospital that they had even back then. It's around 2011. And all kinds of coordination along the border, of patrols and delegations visiting. So that's very fascinating. I did that for about 10 months. And then a unit that deals with something similar that has a lot more available spots for officers that they need to fill the ranks. They offered me the opportunity to move to their unit and do officer's course. So I seized the opportunity. As I said earlier in the podcast, I had to do 6 months initially. And then when I signed on for this first undergraduate position, so to speak, with the Jordan Cooperation, it was 10 months commitment. And then this one said you had to do another 2 years after you finished your 8 months of officer training. So all in all, I ended up doing in this unit, which is the civil administration that deals with all types of non-military things like infrastructure development, like security coordination and civil coordination, movement of Palestinians into Israel. But it deals with everything in Yudan, Shomron, and Gaza, too. And a lot of Arabic is needed there as well, as was the case with the Jordan unit. So I went to officer's course with that unit, did my one position for 2 years, which was liaising with international organizations. They actually wanted my English a little more than my Arabic, but I still spoke to Palestinian finance ministry and different international aid organizations or UN agencies that have local Arabs employed by them. So they prefer to speak in Arabic than English. And I really got to use my Arabic. I felt like this was very practical application, even more so than, for example, I studied international relations at George Washington, and I felt like this was the real thing. We're learning in the classroom all these theoretical stuff. Maybe a few internships in Washington I did, you get some of that taste, but this was the real thing where you're in an army uniform representing the state of Israel, and you're talking to UN agencies about moving donations of medical equipment from Ashdod port to different centers in Yudan, Shomron, or in Gaza, and other types of practical cooperation. That was really, really very fascinating.
Wow, it seems like a very unique experience. Are you able to share any stories or a story about negotiations or conversations during that time?
Yeah, a little bit. There was more high-level stuff that were beyond my reach. I can't say now that it's been some time. If you recall, or your listeners maybe recall, at that point, this is about 2013, there were very bad relations with Turkey after what had happened 3 years earlier with the flotilla that they tried to enter to Hamas-run Gaza. and the IDF didn't want, because it wasn't going through an inspection, stormed it, and there were some militants on board, and there was a violent outcome. 9 Turks died. So as part of the means of trying to improve relations, Israel was negotiating with them about putting a hospital up in Gaza, which would be fully supervised, all the materials that come in through Israel. And that was seen as a way to smooth the relations out. And it was privy to some of those conversations at the very low level with Turkish diplomats and, you know, the people in their embassy that would come to our office next to the defense ministry in Tel Aviv. And that was a very pretty interesting. That's what I most recall. Another interesting thing, though, actually, not negotiation, but very much a moment that made me proud in Israel. One of those moments that you might have. You might have felt this when you were learning there of, wow, only in Israel. This is like really something connecting to why we're here. I was at the Allenby crossing, the border between Jordan and Israel, near Yericho, for my first position, my undergraduate position. And one day I just hear like a lot of marching, it sounds like, and singing. And I'm thinking like, and I see a chuppah then emerging. And I'm thinking like, there's no wedding venue here. Who would be doing a wedding here? Like, what? That seems really crazy. This is a commercial international border crossing. And then as it gets, I see that it's actually a Sefer Torah that they were dedicating. There is a synagogue in the border crossing that some of the workers use, and some of the people from our base were davening when they were stationed there. So they had like a proper ceremony for Hechnasat Sefer Torah, and then they had a Sudat Mitzvah afterwards. And it was some of the workers that I had worked with at the cargo handling and the customs department, that, like, I'd never seen them any outside of work, were just now dancing with the Torah. And it was just very, very moving. And
Wow. And I'm curious, you know, I think there's probably a proportionally almost more articles about Israel politics and negotiations, not only during the war, but in general, than almost anything else. Did your perspective on the news or how you perceived and read the news change after these negotiations?
I mean, my army service when I was involved in these things?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, I think just I saw how much doesn't get covered because the journalists just don't know. And if they do, it's, you might have remembered, your listeners might remember, Matti Friedman from formerly Associated Press wrote that story about how the Western journalists have like a certain narrative to sell about Israel fighting with Palestinians and security all the time. And like these everyday human stories, and just also a lot of cooperation that goes on with Israel and Palestinian authorities behind closed doors, very pragmatic cooperation about water, about electricity infrastructure, and just coordination for, because we're living in a very small piece of land and have to find a way in everyday life lived here. Like that stuff, even when the information's out there, like the news, even in Israel to a certain extent, doesn't really care about that because it doesn't have the same shock value. It was like, oh, there's fire and these people were killed, these people were injured, and explosion or political intrigue behind the scenes. Is there going to be a new government in the Knesset and things of that nature? So I did notice like there was a little bit of a disconnect of just the very real stories that were happening that I saw in my army service. Then just in everyday life, you know, for example, the whole idea of like Haredim and secular always being at each other's throats, which is very common in the media, there's a lot of nuance to that that's not true in everyday interactions and business. And there are already in my service, I saw a lot of Haredi background soldiers that didn't have to enlist but were enlisting to Netzach Yehuda and another unit more attentive to their needs. And just those kind of things gave me a very nuanced perspective that many things aren't as they seem as the media tries, whether in Israel or abroad, tries to create about Israel.
Really, very interesting. And I guess one more question before we discuss the current events. What was life like in Israel after the army? I know that you now have a home in Sderot. It's been covered in the news for today. But if you could briefly discuss, I guess, anything from the end of army service until then.
So I discharged in May 2014 after 3.5 years of service. I had the rank of lieutenant. And then actually, maybe not the funny thing, but the interesting thing was there was this big war. At that point, it was a big war, not compared to today, but Protective Edge, where the three youth were kidnapped in Gush Etzion. And then there was the rocket fire and tunnels from Gaza. So I asked to go back to my unit, and they said no, just because they had enough staff and they were grateful that I went to volunteer, but it didn't work out. I then pursued a master's degree. So I'll be honest, I didn't finish, but other things happened in life. But I started a degree at Tel Aviv University in Middle East History and using Arabic as well, and like Islamic studies, things like that. And then I got this offer initially part-time and then full-time for this current company that I work for, consulting firm dealing with reputation management and government relations, all kinds of communication, APCO Worldwide. It's headquartered in Washington. And the idea grew on me, and just maybe I'm not the best multitasker, but for various reasons, I said the Middle East studies are very interesting, but increasingly, although I saw the workload, and this was a world I hadn't had much experience in before, I was more in the academic background. I said, I want to devote full time to this. I'm going to put my studies on hold. Eventually, I said, hold is going to become forever just locked away in the safe, and continued on. So I've been at this company now about 8.5 years. I was mostly living in Tel Aviv also after I discharged from the army, renting places with roommates and then on my own. And then once I met my wife in a Jewish dating group, she was living in Sderot. A lot of her family's from there. And part of the conditions we said when we decided we want to spend our lives together and that she's the one where that I would come to Sderot because that's where a lot of her family is, her mom, which she's very close and provides a lot of support to. So the idea grew on me. And the more I saw it, and again, this is when we still had rocket threats and very much aware that we're close to the border with Gaza. I saw that most of the time, even then, it was a very quiet community, very open spaces, a place where Baruch Hashem, once we got married, we were able to afford purchasing a home, which is, you know, or an apartment in Israel. That's like considered a not an easily attainable thing, but there the land's much cheaper than in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem area. So I married, my wife's name is Ahuva. She's from the Ethiopian community. Married her in June 2021. Sivan, actually a few weeks after another rocket war, Shomer Chomot, as we call it, regarding the walls, which already then I was exposed to life in Sderot with dealing with rocket fire and being in a safe room, a mamad, for long periods of time. And then we've been there ever since in April 2021, got married, as I said, in June of that year, and slowly building our lives and living like the suburban existence, you know, doing IKEA shopping to furnish the house and other things of that sort.
Oh, right, wow. Hopefully it continues to go well in Sderot and with work. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned you had experienced and heard about occasional rocket fire and shelter life in Sderot. When October 7th comes, what are, it's another one? Is there a knowledge quicker? And also it's on Simchas Torah. How does that play in?
Yeah. So we got woken up on morning of October 7th, Simchat Torah, to rocket fire. Initially, we thought this was much of the same as we'd had several of these rounds. We had the 2021 thing I told you about, summer of 2022, and a smaller conflict just with Islamic Jihad. And then actually even May of 2023, just a few months before, around Pesach time, or Lag BaOmer, actually. And we thought this is more of the same. We go to our bomb shelter. It was Shabbat, but we turn on our phones because clearly, for us, it's a Bikuach Nefesh issue. Even if it's just rockets, and I hate to say that, even if, but still, your dome is not foolproof. So we start hearing interceptions. But then we notice just the, usually there'd be like rocket fire in the past for 20, 30 minutes maximum of several volleys, and then it would be quiet. Maybe then a little later in the day, but this was uninterrupted for about an hour of rocket fire. And we start to, you know, we're trying to get information and also to see what's being broadcast on the news and the social media. And we noticed that there's not any official statements by authorities, not in the city of Sderot, not the national government. And then we see these videos starting to appear in social media about white tender trucks coming into Sderot and to small kibbutzim nearby, and gunmen and paragliders also, the hang glider people that were those motorized gliders. And we get very worried because then we see clearly that by 7:30, let's say about an hour into the attack, this is not a normal day. This is much worse. The rocket fire is also not stopping. It's on Tel Aviv. It's in many farther afield places. And something is very wrong here. And we start to worry about our safety and lock the doors, close the shutters to our home, and try to stay very close to our safe room and have the TV on. We hear gunfire at about 8:30 from Sderot, which I believe was the battle that began there at the police station with the terrorists after they went around in their tender truck shooting at people. Hold up there and try to mount a last stand, a symbolic. We took over this security installation by Israel. Also, at this point, a brother-in-law of mine who's very from and very machmir about going to Minyan, even when there's rocket alerts, he left his phone at home when the rocket started. He walked about a half a mile to where he davens at the Ethiopian Community Synagogue, and he thought this was just like another round of violence. Just to stay close to a bomb shelter while I'm walking. And we have these like concrete structures in Sderot that you can go to, but we don't hear from him for 5 hours when this is all going on. We're very worried and no way to contact him. And eventually he comes home about 11:30, escorted by policemen. And what it turns out happened was he was about a tenth of a mile, a quarter of a mile from where the terrorists came around in the van and shot at different buildings. And he went to some apartment safe room with one of the congregants, one of the members of this minyan. nearby, and they stayed there for a few hours until they saw the police clearing the area. But it was very worrying. For about 6 or 7 hours that day, there was effectively not control of the city by Israel. There was terrorists roaming around freely, shooting people. Overall, 50 people died. A few homes were broken into, and there were some gun battles when the Israeli special forces finally came to extricate them. So it put a lot of scars in the city. We were very worried about our safety. And it was a difficult day, even like just to do regular things like Kiddush and try and have some holiday atmosphere was very, very hard. We also had my brother-in-law has two young girls that they live near Ashdod, but they came for the holiday and they had been here many times before. But just to keep them entertained and not tell them what's going on with like these 3 and 5 year old girls of why can't we go outside and play in the park like we always do? And now we gave them coloring books, even though it's the Chag, we figured in Shabbat that this is very important to keep them calm and not crying and not angry that they can't move around or try to go out. And it was just a very, the day felt like a week long. It was very, very nerve wracking. I benched Gomel afterwards when I got the first opportunity in my reserve duty because we weren't sure. It wasn't a given that we survived. Hashem, thank God, his book and sealed in Yom Kippur that we would make it for that incident. And we hope many more years ahead. But we knew some people that were killed. My wife is also a police volunteer. And she had just finished her training, so several of the people that trained her in the program for civilian volunteers were gunned down as they tried to defend the police station. She was actually on her first patrol the night before in the very same entrance to the city where the white terrorist trucks came just 24 hours later. So that's still very much bearing on her, but thank God she's okay. All of my immediate family are unharmed. There was still a terrorist in and around the city for the next 2 or 3 days, some rockets that hit power lines and made us lose power. So even then, we're still not aware of the whole situation. We're not able to see the TV. We have to conserve our batteries on our phones, and the internet's not great after the power lines are knocked out. So it was very nerve-wracking. We finally were evacuated to the Dead Sea on the fifth day of the war, October 11th. We took belongings for 2 weeks. I took my military gear. Reserve duty already went to draft me on the 7th. As they did most of my colleagues, but just it was logistically with terrorists still inside the city. And then now I had to help my family evacuate. I only came the following Sunday, October 15th. So that's when that period started. But it was, I guess I could summarize that we're just very grateful that we're alive. But this is something that's going to stay with us our whole lives, this experience that we went through. And we've told our story to several media outlets. Now we're telling to you, it's very important to know that this was real. This happened. This is very painful. But it's also, I don't want to say an opportunity. It's something that's allowed us now to rediscover what's important in life among ourselves, our family relationships, doing more mitzvos, doing more connecting and realizing that not everything is precious in life. Hashem, for whatever reason, decided we should stay alive. We don't take that for granted. And we could do now bring more light into the world through our own actions, our own conduct. And hopefully make this Taken Olam B'Machut Shaddai is really something we try to live by now in a way that we couldn't understand in the past.
Wow. It's definitely a moving story and something that really could be covered over many episodes. I'm curious. I think you referenced it once in an interview with a different media outlet. But what does this mean for State Road? You were evacuated. I had heard growing up and in Israel and even now that State Road represented advancement and stronghold against the neighboring countries and then they're evacuated and you mentioned the control that they lost for such a long time. Is this something that's changed residents' perspectives or your perspective?
So in some ways, yes. In some ways, this is even more so how we can set an example for the rest of the country and many other places in the world that are besieged by forces of darkness. It's conditioned on Israel decisively defeating Hamas. And not giving in to international pressure and not letting legitimate concerns about civilian casualties and other things override the need to physically eliminate this organization's terror base in Gaza, its governance. And those things will allow the residents of Sderot and other communities nearby to feel comfortable again and feel that we now have a much safer area. We're not naive that, unfortunately, I think in this land, there's always going to be this hatred of many people that very much represent Amalek who subscribe to this hate Jews and want us out, but we can't leave. This is our home. We're going to fight as needed. We're going to make a thriving society also, but we're going to fight and defend it. But we've shown that as long as there's now addressing the problem that should have been addressed 20 years ago, that was allowed to fester for different reasons. And even then we were resilient, but now we're demanding. A status quo for us is not a returning to October 6th. A new reality for us is that there aren't any rockets whatsoever. And thank God that's mostly been achieved. There's now sporadic fire. It's not ideal, but we're working on getting rid of that too. And there's not the ability to infiltrate Israel by land or sea or air and attack Syria or other communities. And many of the residents are coming back now. Well, actually, the coming Sunday, March 3rd, is when schools phased resuming of schools, starting with high school and then the younger grades. So a lot of families now that were already maybe or postponing their return already came or are now going to come back. I came back once I finished my reserve day with my wife in early January. And I think even up to now, it's like already 50% of return. I think now we're going to see up to Pesach, probably close to 90, if not higher. There will be a small amount, I think, in the single digits percent-wise that won't return. Some of whom had terrorists in their home are like really very raw experiences, and I don't judge them. I understand where they're coming from. But the vast majority of residents, definitely safe to say above 90%, are going to return. And there's going to be more that are going to come. There's the whole phenomenon that I think I discussed in other interviews. Maybe you heard that a lot of reservists, and I saw this when I came back for short visits just to check on the house, many reservists that were stationed in the city, never been to Sderot before. They're from elsewhere in the country in Israel. And suddenly they see, wow, the city is largely intact by the rockets, thank God, and then the terrorists. And it has very wide boulevards by Israeli standards, like very easy to navigate, and open spaces and parks and these modern, beautiful schools. And the idea, and they see the prices of the real estate that were untouched. And they see, wow, much cheaper than Tel Aviv or Haifa or elsewhere in the country. And I think the idea is going to grow on people like that. The word of mouth, they're going to tell their friends, you know, this maybe not... might not be a bad place once Hamas is, God willing, destroyed to raise a family and have a good quality of life. It's also a place where they see there's secular and religious, unlike other places, unfortunately, in this country where that happens, but really respecting each other, people that have barbecues in Shabbat and play music, don't do it too loudly, and those that go to shul like myself and others and keep Shabbat are not imposing our way. A lot of respect among the different residents, even individual families, I see that. And I think that could also be a model for people. So, you know, we had a lot before Simchat Torah, a lot of these very acrimonious, important, but very tense debates on different issues of religion and secular and judicial reform and all these other things. And well, we kind of lost ourselves. And in many ways, perhaps this was whether by Hashem's design or just something that had to happen, we've now returned to understanding. We have, unfortunately, many evil enemies out there that don't care how many differences we have internally. They hate us all because we're Jewish. And we have to address that and be united. And we can then peacefully discuss these other issues and find productive ways to solve them. But I serve as a model for that as well, in addition to being a model for how to stand our ground and not give in to terrorists. And that's the ultimate victory. That's what Hamas wanted to achieve, was that we would leave forever this area. And then they would do another attack, God forbid, several years later. And then Ashkelon would be unsafe and Ashdod and farther away from Gaza. But we're showing them that's not going to be the case. We're only going to come back as a bigger city, a stronger city, more united.
No way. Wow. And you mentioned the media coverage you've gotten since the war, which has been on multiple outlets and some of them multiple times, with updates on your journey. I'm curious, did telling your story on TV change how your friends or family viewed you? And do you have any regrets about that?
No, I don't have regrets. For me, it was very important. I'm not doing it for fame. I wasn't like sharing it on social media. Wow, look at me. I interviewed just with close friends and family. It's important to hear the story and share that story with people. These were outlets also that had a very sympathetic element to me. They weren't asking me questions about the military conduct or other things of that maybe some outlets that are more critical of Israel would be key to do or angles to address. So that was appreciated, that they just let me have my space to describe some very traumatic things we experienced in our redemption or revival in our city. What could you repeat the... I think I lost you in the question.
How family viewed you for sharing it, or if you have any regrets?
So no regrets. I think the family just felt like, wow, you really put your money where your mouth is. Noam, you're very determined. You set an example that a lot of us are inspired by, that you don't back your ground. Like even when I was younger, for example, and I already started talking about it in high school, when I came back from an Israel program and mentioned to the synagogue when I was giving an address, that this is my home, this is where I want to be, and don't tell me welcome home when I come to America, welcome home to Israel only. When I'm in Israel, say welcome home. And now to see, like, well, years later, you actually carried you with that. You didn't just talk a big game when you were younger and dream big, but then to follow through, but you've gone the whole way in your life now. Very real, very authentic in what you've been doing, and this is only further example of that, that you don't back down when you deal with these threats. You really have a deep love of Avat Yisrael, of Am Yisrael, and you're living it. And I'm very humbled by that, that get the support like that. And I think I'm just doing my duty along with every other Yid, and that's we're here in this together, and we have different ways of supporting it. It could be from America also and from elsewhere, to be connected as one people. And I don't say there's one way that's better than the other, but the support I've gotten from family and friends has been nothing short of outstanding on that.
No, great. It's great to see you've gotten support, and hopefully the listeners can also realize the journey and perseverance and commitment you've shown throughout the time. You know, there's so much more to discuss on your wife's side of the family, and even your own journey and service after the war and life before. But as time winds down, we always end with the same question, which is, you know, not just from the past few months, but in general, you've been asked so many questions as a Jew, as an Arabic student all over the world. But there's always questions people are never asked. So looking back at all the questions you were asked, what's a question you've never been asked that you wished you were, and what answer would you give to it?
Might need to take a rain check on one. I wasn't, have to think long and hard. I've been asked so many questions over the years. I mean, maybe something about like why did you come to Israel? Why have you gone on this journey when it could be so much easier abroad in material ways and safety, from a point of view of safety? Is just why this whole route that you've done with the learning Arabic and the other things? So maybe something along the lines of that, but I'm not sure. It's I've taken a natural journey in life, let's just say. So I'm hard to pin into it's like a round peg in a square hole, or maybe I said that wrong. Round hole in a square peg. Forgetting my English as you live too long in
Israel. And I guess even though you might change your question in the future, is there a brief answer you could give to that? Or,
well, I believe very strongly one of the basic principles of Judaism and of human existence is Tzelem Elohim, and everyone has that unique spirit of God. And part of that uniqueness, as we learn from the story of Babel, for example, is everyone's uniquely individual and different from everyone else. So this is my journey, and I've been blessed to take it. I've gotten, I think, clear signs over the years from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this is the path that I should be taking, based on who I married, where I went in life, what I studied, and other decisions. And I'm very happy I've been able to see that through my own life, of how everyone has their individual journey, and we have to respect those choices, and we're not all meant to be the same. And it enriches the condition of life, and it, especially within the Jewish people, it allows for a much healthier dynamic of everyone to do their part to make for a better world.
No way. Great answer. And thank you for all the answers and the time. Sure. Thank you again for joining. Hopefully everyone can connect and learn and grow from your journey. Anything else you want to mention before we end?
I'm not sure. Like if they, I don't know if you share with your listeners some of the stories that they want to look more into it, particularly the written articles, I think do a good job of that. I could share that with you, and you could distribute it, show notes or something like that. But just keep doing what you're doing. I'm keep sharing these beautiful journeys with your guests and everything of what they've done in life.
Thank you so much. Everybody could check the episode comment section, the description, where I'll post links to some of the media coverage on Noam. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this past episode of the Jewish Schmooze podcast. To get our latest updates and contact us, you can follow us on Twitter at Jews_Schmooze. If you want to sponsor an upcoming episode, you can reach out to JewsSchmoozeMarketing@gmail.com. And if you give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening on, that'll be tremendously appreciated. Thank you so much, and hope you're looking forward to the next episode also.